Good evening, listeners. Welcome to another edition of the Kaiju Transmissions podcast, a podcast dedicated to giant monsters and Japanese fantasy. How's that, Matt?
That's better.
You said we should have like a slogan or something at the beginning. Right? To make us look more professional. Is that what that does?
Just like maybe average. At podcasting.
Okay. Well, I can settle for being average. Like, that's fine.
Mediocre.
But yes, I'm Kyle Bird, and that's Matt.
I'm Matt Parmley. Hi.
And we're back. We are going to talk about an obscurity, probably one of the more obscure movies that we've discussed. It also happens to be pretty insane. So we only could do this with the assistance of one of our rotating regular co-hosts, our friend Tom, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into it, but I'm glad I was brought on for this.
It's the only way it could be. And we're talking about Kanto 55, The Great Outer Space Adventure, or sometimes known as Kanto 55, The Grand Outer Space Adventure. Regardless.
Or the big space adventure.
99.9% of the people within the niche of our podcast listeners probably don't even know what we're talking about.
Nope.
Granted, this was a movie we were going to get to eventually. The real reason we picked it is because Matt has a very busy work and life schedule coming up, so we're just kind of trying to crank out some last episodes before he's not really as available. And we were like, okay, well, what's like one movie? What's like an episode we can do easily? It's like one movie. And I was like, well, you know, we could do Kanto 55 because why not? So yes, I'm sure there's listeners who are thinking like, okay, you guys haven't done Gorath yet. And you're talking about Kanto 55. So, I mean, please stick with us.
Big walrus go.
Still the best meme in all of Godzilla-related history.
Yeah, you'll get your giant walrus talk someday, okay? Probably, you know, probably before the end of 2021, if we make it that far. But, you know, this was something easy, light, fun, and something we could just kind of get out into the world quickly. And so, what is Kanto 55, The Great Outer Space Adventure? There's certain ways to tackle that question, right? I guess I can start by saying why we're talking about it on the podcast. And that is because it is a Toho science fiction film. It's from 1969. It's a Showa Toho movie. It's directed by Jun Fukuda. It's got aliens in it and spaceships and all that stuff. It just so happens that it's a film that is not really well known. I guess we kind of have to, now that we have that out of the way, we need to talk about what is Kanto 55. Toho are most famous for, probably here and in Japan, for, you know, their Kurosawa films, you know, their kaiju films, but one of the thing that was really making them a lot of money in the 60s was comedies. We do see that leak into stuff like, you know, King Kong versus Godzilla, and but they comedies made them a lot of money. I'm assuming, you know, that is just a subgenre that isn't very attractive outside of Japan. You know, Japanese comedy, how well is that going to sell internationally? And that's probably why, I would guess, that's probably a big reason why a film like this, you know, is still kind of obscure. And really all the Kanto 55 stuff. So I guess we can explain what that means. Kanto 55 were a comedy duo in Japan. They were Jiro Sakagami, who is the more heavy set of the two. And then the skinny guy is am I getting my guys mixed up?
No, you're right.
Okay. The skinny right. guy is Kenichi Hagimoto. They started as comedians, and originally they were competitors, you know, in the Japanese comedy scene. And eventually they, you know, became a duo and got to know one another, and they are very commonly considered, like, I would like the most, I guess, sensible comparison to our pop culture is, like, they were like the Japanese Abbott and Costello. So like Abbott and Costello, they would make film appearances, TV appearances, and I mean, in the 60s, they were like dominating in Japan. I mean, there were Kanto 55 toys. You know, they would show up in things like comic books. I mean, they were pretty much everywhere. As for what Kanto 55 means, from what I was able to gather, Kanto is more or less a Japanese adjacent word for tail, or usually used in this context is something meaning skit. The 55 is a reference to baseball player Sadaharu Oh's home run record in 1964, which is the year that these guys formed their duo, because they were big baseball fans. The go part seems to be, at least for American researchers, something that isn't quite decided upon. It's been mentioned as meaning as a reference to the go-go, like go-go dancing, or references in go as in a call to action. Anyway, these guys were working steadily and, you know, pretty present in Japanese entertainment until 2011.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, if you Google them, I mean, you can see like more recent pictures of them. I mean, they look pretty much the same, just older. Sakagami died in 2011 of a stroke. So that's pretty much what ended Kanto 55. But yeah, Toho were very, very big creators of comedy films. Like we mentioned in our King Kong versus Godzilla commentary, like the Salaryman comedies, so they did a lot of that stuff. There's the Crazy Cats. There's like 100 Crazy Cats movies they did. That's another, you know, comedy team. So Jun Fukuda did three comedies for Toho with Kanto 55. This one is the only one that has gotten a fan sub. And that is because, I mean, A, it's got that science fiction element, but it was also released with Godzilla's Revenge. Those movies were released together for the Champion Festival, along with some other things, you know, some anime cartoons and stuff like that. Kanto 55 they've done a lot more movies. They've done a lot of them with Shochaku. Those are even more obscure and hard to find. That's a very, very, very condensed history of these guys who, you know, as I've said multiple times, were extremely prolific and popular. There's a little bit of background on just who these guys are. I mentioned this movie was made by Jun Fukuda. I think that's a good next place to start, because we love Jun Fukuda, okay? And if he were alive today and in front of us, no matter how much we tell him that, I really don't think he would care. This is a guy that I mean, we've talked about this, but this is a guy that, you know, he really did not take much pride in his work, especially, you know, I mean, there's many quotes you can find online. There's interviews you can read where he, you know, the interviewer will be like, yeah, the only reason he even agreed to sit down with me is because, like, I wrote him a really nice letter. You know, when you bring up Godzilla, you know, he's one of those guys that's like, this shouldn't never have been a commercial property to begin with. It should have just, you know, the original movie's a classic. They should have just left it alone. And yet he's responsible for a bunch of Godzilla movies. Some of the best, I think we would all agree. You know, the one interview I think we've quoted here before, the guy was like, if you could choose one of your special effects movies to be your favorite, which one would it be? And he said none of them. And he's like, no, but you have to pick. And he was like, well, I guess I would pick Secret of the Telesian, which is probably like the most normal one out of all of them. On that note, though, if anyone that's listening to this caught Stuart Galbraith's panel about Jun Fukuda when we did the Kaiju Masterclass online convention, well, there's a couple things he said. He said, like, you know, if you thought the thing, because he wrote the book Monsters Are Attacking Tokyo, which is like an oral history of tokusatsu, and he said, like, one of the things he said on there was, if you thought that the stuff he said that I published was negative, like, you should have heard the things that I didn't put in the book.
That is the most Jun Fukuda comment I think ever.
and then the other thing he said is, if you thought that he thought poorly of his special effects output, you should have heard what he said about, you know, some of the comedies that he mentioned, specifically the Kanto 55 movies, which he pretty much regarded as just garbage. You know, I mean, if you thought that he didn't like his Godzilla films, he must have absolutely loathed making these. you know, it really sounds like he thought that, you know, almost anything, he could almost be doing anything else, and it would be preferable. So yeah, I love Jun Fukuda, but I think one of the things that I think we can agree on again is that, you know, no matter how much he might not have liked the projects he was working on, or the scripts he was working with, or the budgets he was working with, the guy always, like, brought 100%. Like, he could think the movie he's making is going to be garbage, and he just would bust his ass and still do the best that he could, because he took his job seriously, and he took movies as an art form seriously. You know, this is a guy that thought he was making crap, but because he took his job seriously and did the best that he could, he was able to always implement them with some kind of style. There was always something energetic to them. And everyone that's worked with him always said, like, he was a pleasure to work with. So, you know, he approached this with probably the best attitude anyone could. I think a lot of us, when given a project we don't want... I mean, let's think about our jobs, you know? If you're given a task that you think sucks, you're probably not going to give it your all, but that was not how Fukuda worked. The guy...
In a more just world, he would have at some point been given, like, you know, some money and been told, hey, go, like, make whatever you want.
Yeah,
you know, like, and I would even say in a more modern world, right, like, he made a lot of movies that made money for a studio that was at the time kind of struggling, and or at certain times that he worked for them, and if there was a person like that today, I mean, look at just like Christopher Nolan, for example. He made The Dark Knight, and it was this huge hit, and, you know, Warner Brothers wanted another one, and he was like, yeah, but give me $150 million or whatever the budget was to go make Inception first. And they were like, yeah, oh, okay. You know, like, Jun Fukuda in a more modern world would have cranked out all these movies for one studio that all made money. And then they, at some point, someone would have been like, do you want to actually do anything?
Right. But yeah, I mean, him and even Honda to a degree are like, I love these guys' films. And like, most of the time they're making stuff that like, they don't really want to make. And that it's like, that's part of the reason why, like, the more I've grown up, the more I've kind of written off like the auteur theory. Like, I mean, if you have someone that's good enough and willing to work hard enough, you know, they can make a movie that they think is crap and it can still, you know, come off with some kind of value to it. So yeah, there the more dark side of my sense of humor, there's a little bit of a cosmic it's like a cosmic joke almost that is being played on this poor man, because he's constant, because it's like the dumber a Jun Fukuda movie is, I can only imagine the more miserable he must have been, you know, coming home at night and, you know, going to bed, you know, I don't know, there's something about that tickles me. But it's also, you know, like Tom was saying, there is a very sad element to that, and that, you know, this is a guy that probably could have made a full-blown masterpiece. But, you know, that's just not the time or the place that any of this stuff was going down. Oh, yeah, and then my other favorite quote kind of from him was there was an interview where a guy was trying to ask him about working on Zone Fighter, the TV show, and he's just like, man, why you got to bring that up? He's like, you know, you don't have, we don't he's have to like, talk about that.
I thought nobody would ever see that, basically. Yeah.
Um, Oh, and then there's also the story about how when all these movies were coming out on VHS, Toho sent him a copy of Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster, and he was like, I don't want this. So he just gave it to his daughter as like a gift or whatever. He was like, I don't want this anywhere near me. Here, honey, here, have some movie I worked on. So, Kanto 55, here we see two of Toho's big money-making genres getting put together here. That is comedies and science fiction. Just because I am, I guess, sadistic, I'm going to elect Tom to run us through what this whole thing is all about.
Yeah, see, that's why I was brought on. For the plot synopsis. Strap in. First of all, if you haven't seen this movie, just go do it. There's no way to describe the plot of this movie without spoiling a lot, because it's a comedy, and so you have to talk about, like, in order to talk about some of the plot progression, you have to spoil punchlines of things along the way, right? Like, I feel like that's just how comedy movies are. In order to talk about how the plot progresses, you have to also spoil some of the gags. So if you're interested in this, track it down and watch it, and then listen to me attempt to explain, or not explain, but describe what you've just seen. So,
as always, if anyone has a hard time finding this, drop us a line. I would be willing to steer you in the right direction.
So, it's 1862, Kyoto. And a man is sitting with his geisha, and he's telling her, "Oh, baby, I love you. Let's get married." And she's like, "Oh, you silly thing." And he's like, "No, come on. Surely you are, a leftist who hates the shogunate and wants to unite Japan under the emperor. And let's get married. Yes or no?" And from off screen bursts in another man who's like, "No, clearly this woman is a right-wing ideologist who likes shoguns and likes fascism, and she's my bride." And so basically this is a geisha who's got two men who are her primary customers, who then kind of come across one another. Each of them, like, basically each of them thinks that the stripper really liked him, essentially, is what you've got going on, and they're mad at each other for finding out that the other one exists. So they challenge each other to a duel. As they are dueling, in hilarious fashion, that their duel is like these. Basically, these are two men who are like very antagonistic, and like that, like bravado. They both kind of think they're big men. They're constantly challenging other people to fights and things, but then when it comes time to actually fight, they barely know how to do it, right? They challenge each other to this duel, and for the first like minute and a half of their duel, they just shout "on guard" at each other. Then one accidentally cuts the other one's shirt, and they have a timeout so he can sew his clothes. but as they're dueling, a man wearing a lantern on his head comes up to them, and it's supposed to be like a monk thing. And we actually, if you remember from, if anyone listened to the Batman Ninja episode, a man's wearing a lantern on his head, similar to Red Hood does in Batman Ninja. It's supposed to be like a sign of being a monk. He comes up to them and says, "Oh, you know that girl you're fighting over got so sick of the two of you fighting over her that she has joined a convent." And he takes them to his spaceship and says that's his convent. And they're like, "Oh, yeah, that makes sense." And so they board the spaceship and are essentially kidnapped and abducted and taken into outer space, where the man, this monk, reveals himself as a Peridonian alien. And he needs these two men, these two violent men, to save all of Peroda, I believe is the name of the planet. And they're like, what's wrong? And he's like, don't worry, I need you two guys. Let's go. As they're traveling through space, he tells them, like, hey, take these pills, because we're traveling through space-time, not just space. In order to travel so fast, we're essentially traveling through time as well. Every day we spend out here is going to be like a year for you, so you have to take these special pills that allow your molecules to adjust to space-time. So by my thought, that's got to be one of the earliest mentions of space-time dilation in a movie. It might not be, but still, it's pretty early for that to be being brought into a film. Anyways, they as they're traveling through space, they come across like satellite floating out there, and you know, they say it looks like a pillow. It looks nothing like a pillow, but they say it looks like a pillow, and Dogma, who is the name of the Peridonian alien, is like, oh, that's one of our artificial planets. Let's like make a pit stop there. We'll get some fuel. You know, I could tell everyone, hey, I found the Earthlings that we need, and everyone will be excited because you guys are going to help us save our planet. So they land, and everyone has been slaughtered. And while they're trying to figure out what happened, the ground falls away from underneath them, and they're now trapped underneath the planet by Bluebeard, who is an alien who has taken over this Peridonian satellite, artificial planet, whatever you call it. And he freezes Sarazawa and Sakamoto, which is the name of our two main characters, and he's like, I'm going to freeze you for 1,000 years. And he also falls in love with the geisha. So basically everyone is in love with the geisha along the way. Dogma also wants to marry her.
He's allowed, though, because he has like 7 wives or something.
Yeah, he doesn't understand why humans are so tied to monogamy. He thinks it's stupid. So anyways, this Bluebeard falls in love with the geisha also, and she like starts to kind of basically play along with him to trick him, so that as they are playing a game of like, I don't know, like strip dancing or something.
Yeah.
I guess she grabs his cane and freezes him. Then she goes and hugs Sarazawa, who is the fatter and the fascist kind of guy, and he, because he's so horny for her, melts. That's the cure for this magical Bluebeard space freeze, is to be melted. And then she also hugs Sakamoto, the leftist, the skinnier guy, and melts him. And before they leave, though, they're like, oh, this Bluebeard mentioned something about he has, you know, taken the most beautiful women throughout history and kept them here. Where is he keeping them? And they open a vault or whatever, and they find these thousands of beautiful women. And as they're sifting through them, frozen in blocks of ice, they decide to unfreeze a couple. 5 of them, specifically. And these 5 that they unfreeze are actual historical figures who are known as some of the most beautiful women in history. There's Yang Guifei from China, who was like one of the... What was she? She was the consort to an emperor.
Yep.
In the 700s. She is known as one of the 4 beauties of ancient China. There is Komachi Anono, who was a poet of Japan who is legendary for her beauty. There is Cleopatra, who I think is a little more ubiquitous. Joan of Arc.
Yep.
Who, okay, is Joan of Arc renowned for her beauty?
I really don't know. Think so. It's not something that comes up often when talking about Joan of Arc.
It's not like Helen of Troy, you know, or like the beauty that launched 1,000 ships or whatever. I'm doing them out of order just for the sake of discussion or whatever. But then the other one is Marilyn Monroe. And I don't know if this is just a joke, if this is the joke or if the movie is this low budget or what, but they could not get an American woman. So Miss Marilyn Monroe is played by a Japanese actress. That's amazing. These guys want to bring these five women onto the ship because they're like, these women are kind of putting out for them. But Dogma doesn't want to bring them, not because, you know, they don't have supplies or whatever, but because he doesn't have any more time dilation pills. So he's like, if we bring them, like, they're going to get old. And, you know, our two guys, Sarazawa and Sakamoto, are so bona fide, they don't care. They're like, let's bring these five most beautiful women of all time onto the ship. Meanwhile, the geisha has become kind of jealous that they're sort of ignoring her. And they bring them on the ship. And of course, inevitably, the five women who don't have the time dilation pills all die. They dump their skeletons into space.
I love that part just because it reminds me of the dancing skeleton from House. Like, they're just kind of like out there moving around.
They then go try to apologize to the geisha, and she's like, no, like, you guys suck. And dejected, they sort of forget that they've been fighting, right? Because they've been fighting over this geisha the whole time. And they, like, have this discussion, we're like, what were we even fighting about? And, like, were we fighting about our sixth grade teacher? They're like, no, that doesn't make any sense. And then what interrupts them is that they see another ship that is flying through space, and they're like, oh, let's attack it. And this guy, and Dogma's like, oh, thank God they got their violent instincts back. And they see this ship flying through space, and it is a bottle of Coca-Cola with an American flag planted into it. And Dogma is like, yeah, this was launched from Earth in the year 1990. Americans, or not Americans, but you Earthlings love just throwing shit into space for advertisements. And you especially love ones that have this stupid flag planted in them. Those are the worst ones of all. And, like, goddamn. That's an ahead of its time joke right there.
The kitty meal.
And they're like,
that's the name.
We call it the kitty meal. So they have some of these misadventures in space until they finally get to Parado or however you pronounce it. Once they get there, the Earthlings are then put under observation. It's like they're in a zoo because the Paradonians want to see what makes them so violent. And, you know, our two guys have kind of forgotten why they were fighting with each other. So they just sort of are living their lives, and everyone's like, oh, these two guys suck. They're not even real Earthlings. Real Earthlings are violent, you know, nasty, animalistic things.
We are.
And so they're going to execute Dogma. When they go to kind of start to execute him, Sarazawa and Sakamoto ultimately kind of, like, they save him, and then they start fighting with each other. And the Paradonians are like, oh, look, this is the sort of violence we've been hoping for. And everyone's like, what? Hoping for? And they're like, yeah, because Parado has become so advanced technologically and so enlightened as a planet that all violent tendencies have subsided, and we no longer have any wars or fighting, and our medicine is so advanced, nobody ever dies anymore. And we are, like, dangerously overpopulated because there's basically no death anymore, and we need to bring back some violence to start killing some people. And they're like, how about you two Earthlings? Like, we'll pitch you in any contests against one another that you want. The more, you know, like, the more violent, the better, however you want to do it, however many you want to do. But whoever wins gets the girl, and whoever loses, we are going to dissect your brain and take out your violent tendencies and harness the hormones of it and use it as hormone therapy to make us more violent, which will kill people, and also it'll make our youth more sexed up and crazy. So they want that because their society has become so passive. So then our two guys face off in a duel, where one of them is dressed like a Mexican and the other is a cowboy. They face off in a boxing match. They face off in a go-kart match and have a horrible crash in their go-karts. They fracture both of their skulls. While the Peridonians are fixing their brains, they manage to extract their violent tendencies without killing them. So they get the hormone therapy for themselves and make Sarazawa and Sakamoto both very docile, to the point where they're like, constantly like, oh, you go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. Like, I insist. I insist. And that's a joke that plays out really well with some eggs. And meanwhile, the Peridonians' violent tendencies are ramping up to the point where they nuke the planet into oblivion. Sarazawa and Sakamoto manage to escape with the geisha. They return to Earth. It's the year something, the future, and the U.S. and the USSR are still poised on the brink of nuclear war, and these two guys are like, please, no more war, no more war, and everyone just thinks they're crazy because they insist they're from 1862, and they get put in a mental institution. The end. That's the movie.
The thing is, even hearing you describe it doesn't fully capture how bonkers and zany all of it is. Also, the geisha gives birth to a child for each of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The movie ends with, like, her lamenting, like, well, maybe there's a planet somewhere for my two kids. Right. That's like the closing scene.
Yeah.
Tom, you forgot to mention how the two guys walk. They, like, hop.
Oh, yeah. It's this crazy thing where, what's really insane is the one guy hops a little bit more, like, forward and backward, and the other guy hops a little bit more left and right, and they're like, I can tell by the way you hop that you're an imperialist.
The way they hop is, their movements are done after shogi pieces. Shogi is a Japanese game. It would be like if you knew two guys who only walked by hopping in the movement of, like, different chess pieces.
That's bonkers.
Also, the geisha girl, Kogiku, she's played by Noriko Takahashi, who is the girl at the bar in Frankenstein versus Baragon when Baragon comes and, like, kills everybody. And she was the original Dio for Godzilla versus the Sea Monster. They started filming with her as Dio, but she had appendicitis and she was replaced by Kumi Mizuno. You can there's pictures of her in the outfit and everything. If you Google search it, but So yeah, that's the Great Outer Space Adventure. You know what's weird? You know what's weird is this. There's actually a few really kind of heady, like, philosophical.
There's a ton of like little things in it too, right? Like, just like one of the little things is they both, this Sarazawa and Sakamoto, are in love with this geisha, right? And she doesn't even know their real names.
Right.
She calls them Mr. Say and Mr. Sa.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a lot of, like, really, like, interesting philosophical things that are brought up in this movie, which is, like, what was the last movie that was this stupid that actually hit, like, raised a lot of really interesting, like, topics, you know? I mean, the whole idea of this utopian society that wants to be violent because they're so bored. Like, that's an interesting sci-fi concept. Like, we get a little bit of that in that Neo Ultra Q episode where there's those they like genetically engineered people where like they were like, yeah, we're too perfect. It sucks. Yes,
the people who can like read body language so well they never have to. It's called like the town that doesn't talk. Yeah, or something.
Were they
like that,
automatons,
right?
Or something? But yeah, they were like we're too perfect and we hate it. So like yeah, there's this whole like issue of like the role violence plays in human nature and you know, of course the whole you know thing at the end where you know with this mother questioning if Earth is a place fit to raise her children because it's on the same path that this other planet that just nuked itself is on, and
whether that self-destructive tendency is part of all of human nature.
Yeah, and it also has a little things here that they even show at the end, you know, with the Russian and American flags, you know, the kind of uncertainty Japan was feeling at the time in the middle of the Cold War. Like, there's a lot of really interesting concepts woven into this incredibly silly and dumb like farce of a film.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah,
I don't quite know how to process it, honestly. Like, it's
insane. Like, there's so much humor in it, right? And like, it's very like foreign humor is not always easy to pick up on, right? Like, I mean, it's probably my least, like, that's why humor is one of the hardest genres as a whole to even talk. First of all, humor as a whole is like so subjective, you know. It's one of the hardest genres to talk about because humor is so subjective. And then when you get into like foreign language humor, you especially start getting into things that are like culturally specific and like, you know, just you don't get it, because like if someone makes a joke about like, I don't know, how the American healthcare system sucks, or you know, we shoot each other all the time and shit like that, like you, everyone gets it. But if you were from like Japan, you might not, right? I mean, and maybe America is a bad example because we're such assholes and we intruded our bullshit into everything, but like you kind of get what I'm driving at, right? Is like foreign humor is so hard, but there's a lot of humor in this that's just really broad and really like works super well. And then you like almost smash cut to these like nuking the world. it's jarring, but in a fun and good way.
The movie's just
an acid trip.
It's a very bizarre movie. There's not much, I don't know, there's really not much you can do to prepare somebody for it, you know? But yeah, I found some of the sci-fi stuff to actually be like pretty thought-provoking and deep. But yeah, I mean, it's as deep as you can get in a movie like this, really. But it's one of those things where, like, I don't want to give it too much credit, but I also want to make sure it gets the credit that's due.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's tough to know. One of the good examples of, like, I don't know how much credit, like, I don't know if this is a joke that's supposed to be funny or if this is just a random thing, right? When they bring out the five women, right? And they bring out the Chinese woman first, and then Cleopatra, and then Joan of Arc, and then Marilyn Monroe, and then, like, and finally Japan's beauty. And, like, she doesn't walk up the ladder, and they're like, oh, she's so, she's like, they say she's so uptight, or she's nervous, or something like that. Is that a, I don't know if that's a, is that like a joke about that woman? Do you know what I mean?
Does it have something to do with, you know, how women are perceived in Japan? Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I wouldn't know how to answer it, but
that's just one of those things. Is that a really, really insanely clever thing that we don't get because we are dumb? or is that just like a random, really random joke, you know? And it's hard to know, right? Because, like, As I've been watching stuff like Ultraman and Ultra Q, there's things that I've been like, that is so friggin' random and weird. And then I mention it and, you know, someone will be like, oh no, that's actually like a very common Asian folklore or Russian piece of pop culture trivia. And I'm like, oh, I've never heard it, you know? So, like, I don't know if this is something that's just supposed to be funny.
Well,
I mean, it's supposed to be funny, but I don't know if it's supposed to be like based off of one of the stories around this woman, or if it's just random humor.
Because
there's some totally random humor in this too, like, you know, a guy pausing a fight in the middle of a sword fight to sew his clothes, and another dude bending his sword, and and, like, you know, the ground falls away from them and they fall, and when they land in the ground, they're imprinted into the ground. Like, there's just random humor in it too. So I don't know about, there's some stuff in this that I didn't know, that I didn't laugh at, that I didn't know if was maybe funny on a different level.
Yeah. I mean, there's enough broad humor in it to make, you know, make it not completely impenetrable.
100%.
Matt, what were your first impressions?
I actually had a lot of fun with it. I watched it. I watched the first half with Landon because I was trying to get him to go to bed. And, it is really funny, and then you have the weird, like, tonal shift at the end where everybody dies, and they, like have, like, the last war stock footage where everything gets blown up. But it also, it kind of makes you think about, like, you have these two guys that are essentially supposed to be not just fighting over the geisha, but, like, sworn enemies. They have different political parties. They want to see Japan unified, but in different ways. And then they end up being, because of their violence, they end up, say, like, quote unquote, being the saviors of this world because they want to have everything destroyed. And then they realize that when they get back to Earth, like, they don't want those things to happen anymore. And it's just, I don't know. It really does kind of make you think about our destructive tendencies in a way that you would not expect from a movie that starts out with him like screaming on guard and bending their sword and all the crazy dancing skeletons or floating skeletons in outer space, or like the Bluebeard grabbing them by the belt and looking to see if they're female or not. Like, just so bizarre.
Yeah, even the two guys, Jiro Sakagami's character, the more heavy set guy, he's a police officer for the Shinsengumi, who was kind of a right wing special police force organized by military government in Japan at the time. And they were adamantly opposed to the attempts that other groups in Japan were making towards, you know, being more inclusive and, you know, opening up more trade routes with other countries. You know, they were the isolationists. So I'm assuming the other guy is, you know, his school of thought is expanding Japan to be more inclusive of others. But yeah, it's interesting that, you know, after fighting for so long, they're just like, what are we fighting about again? but yeah, no, I first saw this movie whenever it was first subtitled, which was probably a little over a year ago. And I just remember thinking, like, okay, this is something we're going to have to talk about this on the podcast because it's bananas. I've been wanting to cover this movie for a while just because this is not the kind of movie that, I would say we're really used to.
It's hard to talk about, honestly. Anyone is used to.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, and you know, you have this whimsical score, which, by the way, was composed by Kenjiro Hiroshi, who I think most people would know. He is the composer of the Gamera March from the Showa Gamera movies. Not sure if you guys could tell.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
The main theme sounds a lot like, not the Gamera March, but I think it's the music in, is it Virus?
Yeah, he did the score for Virus, and then, his theme, the Gamera March was, you know, continued to be used through the rest of the series. So that tracks.
Yeah, it's like the music in this sounds a lot like very, very similar to the score from that movie.
It's also worth mentioning, since this movie was made at a unfortunate time where, you know, Eiji Tsuburaya was not well. And so, you know, the special effects department at Toho was in complete chaos. And I think most of their A-list effects technicians were working on Godzilla's Revenge, including this fellow, Yoichi Minota. But he was the director of special effects for this. This is the first thing that he was the actual special effects director for. But he worked on stuff going back to the original Godzilla and most of the 60s Toho films. He directed effects for a bunch of Return of Ultraman and some Jumborg Ace, Megaloman, and apparently cinematographer for Godzilla vs. Hedorah, but he was left in charge of the effects, which, you know, is mostly, I think most of your tokusatsu stuff is in your miniature spaceships and satellites and Coke bottles. um But yeah, this movie gets into all kinds of stuff. I mean, even you know, if monogamy is necessary.
Yeah. And American imperialism and obsession with branding and ads.
Yeah, and then the character Dogma, apparently he explains the nature of his name. Doe is in a female deer. Goo is in gummies. And then Ma is in Mahjong, which is a Chinese game. So yeah, I mean, if it's sounding like this makes no sense, I mean, that would be
because
that would be
doesn't.
Accurate. And yeah, it also kind of does poke fun a little bit. We kind of mentioned it earlier, but it does poke fun a little bit about, you know, the sexism of these two guys. You know, especially when, you know, they're just not listening, when he's like, yeah, if we bring all these women on board, they're gonna die in, like, a couple days. And then as they're aging, they're saying, like, oh, they're all old, we have all these old hags on our ship now.
And then they die, like, it's like smash cuts to them being dead. Well, that's... They die, they're skeletons, and they're like, oh my god, it's so terrible, and then they just dump the skeletons in this space. Just like,
but yeah, they're so wrapped up in this idea of like, oh, we just took, you know, what, five of the hottest women in human history, and you know what happens is whatever, you know, that whole side plot of going to that planet really kind of, I guess that's almost like the punchline to that entire sequence.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of Bluebeard, we should talk about Bluebeard, who I guess is an alien who's just decided to take over this planet and store it with all the most beautiful women in history.
Yep. That's his plan.
And it's a guy wearing like pancake makeup and like really like blue. It doesn't even look like hair. It's like blue, like yarn.
Cotton candy looking
or something.
He's got like eyeliner on, I think. It's real. That whole sequence with him and the geisha, though, is hilarious because they're doing, like, I think they start off doing rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, yeah,
dance
strip,
form.
Yeah, yeah. It's strip, rock, paper, scissors, and then it turns into this weird song about baseball.
and then the way that she steals his staff, and she's like, he's asking her to take her top off because she lost that match, and she's like, well, turn around, and then he starts making all these, like, nasty, like, cooey sounds, and she grabs the staff and freezes them or whatever, but it's actually pretty funny and well done.
And yeah, the third act, I think, is probably the most interesting. That's when, yeah, they get in a go-kart crash or whatever. And they remove their violent tendencies and inject the, and you know, mass distributed as pills for everybody, and then within like 3 minutes, there's like mass shootings and and riots and stuff.
Did they just like inject American into those people? Is that what happened?
Yeah, pretty much. That's like they injected 2020 America
into their veins.
And then yeah, then they're like, okay, you guys gotta leave because the nukes are gonna blow us all up. And yeah, then we see that the geisha herself, she learned, I guess, that monogamy was pointless and had kids with both of the guys, and like they seem pretty cool about it. so yeah, it ends with them coming to Earth as a thruple. And then the two guys are telling everyone what happened, and they sound like lunatics, so they go to an insane asylum.
After protesting outside of the American and Russian embassies.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. They interrupt these protests, and they're like, we just came from a planet where everyone blew each other up. And everyone's like, ha, what? And then they're locked up, and the mother is left with the two kids, and she's like, this planet's gonna blow up, so I should find somewhere else. And that's how the zany, wacky outer space comedy ends.
It's insane.
Yeah.
There's also I alluded to this in the plot summary, when they're first, like, you know, nonviolent, and they sit down. And she's like, here, have some breakfast. And she, like, made them eggs. And she lays down a plate of eggs. And she's like, here, have some breakfast. And they're like, oh, you know, you go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. And then, like, it cuts away to, you know, all the Parodians, like, Parodonians, like, murdering each other and looting and rioting and shooting the shit out of each other. And then it cuts back, and they're arguing over a plate of baby chickens.
Yeah, they've been arguing so long the eggs have hatched. Yeah, that was a good gag.
What is your favorite joke in the whole movie? I'm just curious.
I think mine's the skeletons, just because it's like a smash cut to, like, the most disrespectful thing.
And they're like almost dancing. It's hilarious.
Mine was probably the Coca-Cola satellite.
Yeah, that was mine too. The joke about the flag.
Yeah.
Put their flag everywhere.
It's like, for some reason, people keep putting this flag in these advertisements and shooting it in space. We hate it. yeah, no, this is something that, you know, I didn't really know what to expect. You know, the first time I watched it, I knew it was a comedy. I knew it was a Champion Festival thing. I knew it was Jun Fukuda. And I was like, okay, what's this all about? And then, like, just gradually, like, it was like every 10 minutes, something crazy would happen that would be crazier than, like, whatever happened 10 minutes before that. And then it leads up to just a planet blowing up.
It's both funny and witty and charming, and has and it makes you think in ways that you would not expect it to make you think. Plus, it's 80 minutes or whatever, so, like, it's super easy watch.
What would Jun Fukuda say if he could hear us talking about this right now?
I hate these guys, and I hate myself for making this movie.
Like, yeah, probably. I was just thinking, after they throw the skeletons into space, the one guy says it was just an honest mistake. Even though they were warned ahead of time. And then the other guy goes, well, I don't know. I mean, even though they were once beautiful, they still had skeletons on the inside of them. I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
I don't know.
But yeah, Jun Fukuda, this movie, I don't know, like, because he still went on and did a lot of things after this, so I want to say that this movie probably broke him, but this movie was probably just like another Tuesday in his miserable life.
Yeah, probably, you know.
Like, he was probably just like, oh, it's another day of the worst day of my life so far.
Yeah, I know Sea Monster was pretty rough on him, you know. And then, yeah, it just, his career just got crazier and crazier. Because, you know, after this, you get to, you know, Gigan and Megalon and Zone Fighter and Mechagodzilla. And then, like, his final feature film is War in Space.
What do you think June Fukuda felt better about? Watching these two clowns hop around all the time, or seeing Godzilla slide on his tail?
That's tough.
Well, yeah, his attitude towards Godzilla was like, this should have just stayed this one movie that's like this chilling allegory for, you know, nuclear war and what Japan went through, and you know, less than, like, what, 20 years
less than,
later?
Less than 20 years, less than 20 years later, the guy who's in the Godzilla suit in Megalon is acting like a frigging spaz. He's hopping around in that suit as much as these guys hop around in this movie. What about when they don't know how to eat bananas?
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, the first guy Sarazawa, the chubbier one, he starts like
trying to drink it.
Yeah, and then the other guy's like, "No, you idiot, you're reading it all wrong." And then he takes the banana, peels it. This is a great joke. Peels it and then throws the banana away and starts eating the peel. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I forgot about that's that. That's a good joke.
Hey, and then for people wondering, we're Godzilla. The one guy has a Godzilla back tattoo.
That's right.
Yeah, he does.
That's right. You know, I kind of want to get to, because like we're talking about this. We seem to all, you know, have some pretty good things to say about it. But this definitely is one where it's like, yeah, I can see why this does not. I mean, it's unfortunate because, yeah, every movie should be seen, unless it's like child porn. I think every film, you know, should be able to be seen, you know, whether
it's a low barber, just so you know.
Well, my point is, I think art should be, you know, should everyone should be able to see it. But yeah, I commercially speaking, I don't know that there's a market really for a movie like this here. I mean, of course it would be great, you know, if, you know, Arrow or whatever is like, oh, here's a Kanto 55 box set. But it's like, even within that, like, small audience of, you know, who would buy an Arrow Blu-ray, it's like, how much interest would there be? It's like, that's kind of what I was saying earlier.
The tough part is, you know, there'd be no upfront interest. This movie would need like a this movie would need an a dub, for one thing, with like a Mystery Science Theater riff or something. Like, this movie would need some kind of a boost, right, from a Mystery Science Theater, or even like airing on a, see, this is before, you know, the basic death of television essentially, but like airing on like a late night, like a Joe Bob type of thing, you know, like, I mean, obviously this wouldn't be so much up Joe Bob's specific alley, but, you know, like having this movie done with like a host kind of coming in and talking about it a little bit during commercial breaks, like, because I do think the movie itself is offbeat and insane enough to get a cult following here, which would get it to enough, you know, enough of a following for someone like Arrow to deem it worthy of putting out in a limited edition, but not on the name Kanto 55 Grand Space Adventure alone. You know, it would have to be like Kanto 55 Grand Space Adventure as seen on, you know, that one episode of Mystery Science Theater, or Joe Bob, or Sven Gulli, or whatever, you know, like.
Well, I just wonder, Kanto 55 in general, like, what kind of appeal would they have outside of, like, diehard, like, Japanese cinema buffs, you know?
I don't know. I've not seen their other movies, which, you know, apparently that's not something that's really on the table.
I would watch them if it was.
I would too after this one.
Yeah. Yeah, I would totally. Well, yeah, I would totally check out more if it was available. But yeah, I mean, it's just there are these little, I guess, nooks and crannies in Japanese film that are important, but still very hard to reach for anyone outside of Japan, you know. And you know, I commercially understand why, but it's still unfortunate because it's like, yeah, I would like to see as much cool stuff as I can while I'm alive.
I mean, for whatever it's worth, it's popular enough in Japan that this movie got two different DVD releases. It has not been released on Blu-ray in Japan, from what I can tell, but it was released in 2006 as a DVD with an audio commentary by, I'm trying to see if that's someone, I don't know who the person who did the commentary was.
It might be like a scholar or
yeah. And something. Then it was re-released in 2014 for the Toho DVD Cinema Fan Club. I don't know what that is, but so it had two different DVD releases. So, and one of them fairly recently. So,
you know, the only thing I could see like that would make sense is if someone like really low to the ground, like SRS, was acquired it for like a limited run that probably wouldn't sell well because there's no Godzilla or whatever. But you know, that's the only thing that like would make sense is like a release, but you know, I mean, I bet Toho would ask an arm and a leg, you know.
Oh, you want this movie nobody's seen or heard of? That'll cost you $10 million.
Criterion could probably do it too. Like Criterion, I think, has the name cachet to themselves to, if they put out like all four of their, or three, this, however many of them. Yeah,
this is one of those things where I don't think they'd still do them, but if they were still doing those like Eclipse box sets, like this would be a good one. Like put out the Kanto 55
like filmography.
Yeah, set of like three, four whatever movies, like that would be like a pretty ideal way to do it. But, you know, Toho is also Toho, and they're gonna do.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? Is this if this was under the umbrella of like a Shochiku or something?
Yeah, they'd be like whatever.
We probably would have it. You know what I mean?
True.
Because there's no way Criterion paid more than a few shekels for, like X from Outer Space, Goke, Genocide, and Living Skeleton, you know, like.
Well, I know at one point Criterion was interested in the Blue Pearl, Honda's first movie, which in Japan, I don't think Toho's even put out. And they were like, yeah, we're going to need like, you know, your firstborn children or something, you know, so.
Right. So that's another thing though, that kind of points to how marketable this is in Japan, at least, right, is that Toho hasn't even put out Honda's like first movies, like,
yeah,
first,
so
couple,
well, yeah, and you know, like we were saying at the beginning, like these guys had a very long and prolific career. I mean, they were still doing stuff up until the one guy Sakagami died. So, I mean,
that's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, these guys were institutions.
Good for them. Assuming they actually got to make some money off of it, I guess I'll say.
Right. We've been overall, and I think we all kind of land overall positive on this movie. But I mean, if you had to, you know, pick some, I guess, negatives beyond what we might have talked about, you know, like maybe not picking up on some more culturally specific jokes or whatever. I mean, where would you guys kind of point to as stuff that didn't quite work?
I think the ending's a little weak, like the very ending. But you know, that's also something that I could see in future rewatches almost being like the joke unto itself, you know, like how the ending of Monty Python and the Holy Grail is just them all getting arrested. Like the ending of this is just them getting thrown in a mental institution.
Yeah.
It's like such a bit of like non-humor and so anticlimactic that it becomes a joke unto itself. But in the moment on my first watch, I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. You know, that doesn't really work for me. I'm not all 100% sure that the sexism stuff is all as much of a winky commentary as we're kind of sometimes thinking it is, you know, like, there's the moment where Dogma has Kogiku and he's like, why don't you marry me instead of those two? They're such jerks. And she's like, no, you're too much of a pansy. Women like a man who can fight.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's like not supposed to be like a subversive joke, you know? So there's some of that kind of stuff that like creeps in, like even though I think at times it might be kind of playing up the sexism and undercutting it, I think at times it's still playing into it.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the ending. I would say for me, part of it's going to be just that not understanding all the cultural references that are present. And because of that, it's not a negative on the film as much as like, maybe I just don't get some of it. The other part is comedy is very difficult. And the one, the heavy set guy, all of his mannerisms are extremely exaggerated. And sometimes it worked for me and sometimes it didn't. It felt like he was always making these like funny faces and getting bonked on the head in a couple sequences. And it kind of felt like, okay, you've already played that shtick. But I don't really have anything negative to say. It's like the movie made me laugh. Is it like a stone cold classic, so to speak? No, but like it does things that no other movie does, and I have to give it credit there. And whether that's good or bad, I think this is one of those things where your mileage may vary based on how much you like comedy. For the record, Bird is not like doesn't love comedies, and he seems to be getting a kick out of this. So that should tell you there's definitely a charm to it.
I think it when I do engage with comedy, I prefer things that get very surreal, and this is a very surreal film. I think Tom kind of summed up anything I would point at as a real negative. I'm not sure how the whole side quest on to the one planet where they find Bluebeard and all the, you know, the hot women, you know, I'm not exactly sure how much that's really needed is story wise, you know, but it's also one of those, you know, it feels a little bit like maybe filler almost, which is kind of the second act of the movie, but it's also one of those things where it's like it's a really kind of weird comedy that is kind of unpredictable and surreal, so it's like I don't really want to leverage that complaint too much, especially because it plays out in a way that's still entertaining. And yeah, the movie is short; it's just over an hour, so it's also a quick watch. But yeah, no, I like it. A good amount, you know, it's something that I'm sure I would revisit at some point. And it's made me interested in, you know, if any more Kanto 55 movies show up, you know, with an English translation, I would gladly check them out because
I would watch them.
I'd definitely check it out. I think these guys, you know, I can see why they were kind of the sensation that they were, and you know, it's a world that I would like to, you know, dive into more if I ever get the chance. So,
this is like the closest I've ever seen to a foreign movie hitting that Zucker style of humor, the top secrets and the airplanes, like, you know, in those movies, like, anything could be a punchline and anything could be a joke at any point, right? And it would be sometimes really smart stuff that was like really funny play on words, you know, like, surely you can't be serious, I am serious, don't call me surely, you know, like stuff like that, that's like just a funny play on words, to something that's just like really, really stupid. And that's this has a lot of that going on in it, you know, like there's some stuff that's like really clever, like, we hate that specific flag, they think they can plant it in anything and just shoot it into space and that makes it theirs. Like, that is very like witty and very funny also. But then there's also, you know, the guy sticks his sword into a tree stump and it bends. And then he fights with a bent sword for the rest of the fight. Like, that is stupid. And it just, like, that's my wheelhouse of humor, you know, in a lot of ways, is that, like, airplane and top secret. And this is, like, the closest I've seen to that from a foreign film, I think, maybe ever.
Okay, so
or I'll say foreign language, right? Am I not supposed to say foreign? Is that like being,
as long as you don't call China or as long as you don't call Taiwan a country, you'll be okay.
Oh, okay.
or else we'll make you issue an apology. That just got us canceled in China or whatever. But I don't know. Are we even available in China?
Probably not. Talked about ghosts.
That's true. Yeah. I know a bunch of, like, social media stuff isn't even around. It, like, they have different things than we do. Okay, so how many... oh, wow. How many...
There's anything. How many Asian Marilyn Monroes? How many... dancing space skeletons, how many time dilation pills,
how many Coca-Cola bottle satellites do we want to give this one out of 5?
How many kiddie meals?
Yeah.
I'm going to give this a very solid 3 poorly eaten bananas.
That's a good one.
It is a lot of fun. I can see that easily going up upon, like, rewatches, but it's definitely worth checking out. And like I said, it's both charming and short. So if you got an hour to kill, throw it on. And again, I don't think that we've done this film any justice with even trying to sum up how insane it is, because when you watch it, it's even more so. I don't know how to explain that. You just have to sort of experience it.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's an experience.
Well, there's an energy to it that's sort of lacking when you try to explain it chronologically and stack it all up and and unpack it all.
Yeah,
right?
it's like trying to summarize like the panda episode of Ultraman Ace. It's like you just need to see it to believe it.
it's like trying to describe like the drug trip you had, you know, and like everyone's like, that doesn't sound so insane. You're like, no, no, trust me. If you were there, it was insane.
Yeah. All right, Tom, what's your rating?
I loved it. I really loved it. I had a lot of fun with it. You know, I also have been watching a ton of Ultraman, so casual sexism is like becoming, you know, just something I'm used to now. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I really had a lot of fun with it. I laughed a ton. I'm not 100% sure I laughed at everything that was an actual joke. I think I didn't laugh at some things that might have been clever jokes. But that is that's part of the reason why comedy is so great, is it's so subjective that, you know, when these Peridonians are murdering each other and they're standing right next to each other and shooting each other and somehow missing. I don't know if that was like just some bad staging. Like, there's also moments where they're fighting each other when the chaos is breaking out and they're not hitting each other at all and flying all over the place as if they're beating the crap out of each other. Again, I don't know if that was just like poorly staged action or part of the joke, but I thought it was hilarious. And so, yeah, I laughed a ton. It's only 72 minutes. Like, that's amazing. I like a nice, short, sweet runtime. I give it a 4 out of 5.
On Letterboxd, I gave it a 3, but the more I'm kind of dwelling, I kind of want to be the middleman between the two of you and do a 3.5. Just because this is... I can't say that I've seen a movie quite like this. which alone is worth half of a star.
And there is that Fukuda energy to it. You know, I mean, if you're one of the people out there who watches Son of Godzilla and Godzilla vs. Gigan for the cast, like I do, you should... I would be shocked if you didn't love this movie.
Right, yeah. No, I would recommend this to someone that likes Jun Fukuda's stuff. But that's why he's awesome. I mean, this is a guy that was assigned this film, and he hated it, and he still brought 100% to it. And that shows, you know. He might not have cared for the project, but the guy liked his job enough to... You know, he never half-assed it. That's why he's great. On that note, that has been Kanto 55, The Great Outer Space Adventure. I would recommend people try and track it down. If anything, it'll be a unique experience.
to say the least.
Yes.
It is very unique. And that's, God, I, when you watch a lot of movies, that unique becomes like such a breath of fresh air. I actually had this thought about a different movie that I was watching, an Adam Wingard movie, one of his earlier ones. I watched A Horrible Way to Die, and... This is just in general thought, kind of about Kanto 50. It's about Kanto 55 and that movie. To be able to do something that feels familiar, right? Like, I talked about this feeling like that sort of Zucker Brothers kind of humor to me. To be able to do something that feels so familiar, but at the same time feels like something you've never seen and manages to sort of, you know, subvert the expectations a little bit and be both familiar and unique and creative at the same time, that's really, really hard to do, right? Like, I do a lot of excusing of lazy plotting or lazy scripting in the name of defending creativity. And I also do a lot of defending of tropey kind of generic stuff in the defense of it being really well executed. I love it when something comes along that that can really do both. This is well executed. It's got a frenetic, fun, fast energy to it. It's really creative, and it's pretty well written.
All right. Well, yeah. No, I agree. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I meant to do this like a few times now. I want to give a shout out real quick to a friend of mine. His name is Joseph, and he and his friend Ian just wrapped up the first season of an Evangelion podcast called The Human Instrumentality Project. I've known Joseph for many years. We met on the set of a doomed fan film that is, you know, that's a topic for neither here nor there.
That's a good podcast episode. Bruce.
it's excellent. I mean, he's a really smart guy, and you know, they do a really good job of deconstructing the series without sounding pretentious, which I think is something that's missing from like 99% of all Evangelion discourse. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I think there's a lot of crossover with our listeners and that series, and I think that they would really enjoy it. So check that out.
How would you say it would play for someone who thinks Evangelion is a pretentious piece of shit?
I think you'd probably come away with a different understanding of it. But that's just me.
Hey, I didn't say that's me.
Well, I answered your question regardless.
We are going to get so much hate mail to not have Tom back based on that comment.
I assume you get tons of hate mail every time I'm on anyways.
I mean, truth is the only time we've really gotten a lot of blowback is with Shin Godzilla.
And all October every year.
No.
Why is that idiot back on?
We did. My favorite negative comment we've ever gotten was when somebody said that that our podcast was two white boys talking about Godzilla. I was like, well, clearly they don't know that Bird is not white. So they didn't listen to us very well.
All right, well, this time we're just wasting the poor listeners' time. I just wanted to give a shout-out to my friend's goddamn podcast. So let's get out of here. Thank you for listening to the Kaiju Transmissions podcast. Please take a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher. Make sure to subscribe for all the latest episodes. You can also check us out on Twitter at @KT_podcast. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook at Kaiju Transmissions. And you can email us at kaijutransmissions@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments. And we will see you next time.